listening to the Franchise Podcast Network, presented by Lucky Star Casino. KRXO FM and KRXO HD Oklahoma City, a product of Tyler Media, reaching over 1 million Oklahomans every week. Now, the Outdoor Hour, giving you the inside scoop on the great outdoors on 107.7 The Franchise.
As long as I can remember, I've been drawn to the outdoors. There's something primal in each of us that awakens when we step outside the bounds of modern society and back into the vast possibilities of the natural world. The more civilized our lives become, the louder our hearts cry for reconnection with our native ways. Failure is imminent, dangers drawing nigh, but approached with reverence and tact, the outdoors return wisdom and gain. In both the outdoors and in life, harvests are fleeting, but lessons and memories abound. With that in mind, we step forth boldly together in pursuit of ourselves outdoors. We are nothing more than tree stand troubadours. Welcome inside the Outdoor Hour. My name's Taylor Maples, and we've got something a little different lined up for you this week on the Outdoor Hour. For the very first time, we're pushing the Outdoor Hour outside of the radio studio. Last week, I spent some time fly fishing in the salt water of the Space Coast of Florida with a good friend of mine, Captain Noah Miller, and we recorded some segments discussing tarpon fishing, snook fishing, talking about one of the most unique fisheries that I've found in the Banana River and Indian River lagoon systems just on the Atlantic side of Florida, Cocoa Beach, Cape Canaveral, Melbourne, Grant, that area of Florida. And I'm really excited to bring you on the skiff as we fly fish for saltwater game species this week and have a really cool conversation about an awesome fishery and some of the threats to that fishery. There are some ongoing battle and dispute between commercial fishermen, weekend warrior anglers, fishing guides, different political groups, different developers, homeowners, those sort of things. And it all has a huge impact on the fishery, the natural habitat, these game fish species, and people's abilities to enjoy, recreate, and even make livings on the water. So I hope you enjoy this week's episode. You'll hear some unique sounds. You'll hear me casting a fly rod, stripping in line. We actually catch some fish throughout this interview, which is a really neat experience to share with you. You'll hear Captain Noah Miller back up on a pulling platform, pushing us through this shallow water along these salt flats as we search for fish. I hope you enjoy the sounds of the Space Coast. I hope you enjoy a glimpse into saltwater fly fishing. But most of all, I hope you learn to appreciate and find ways to advocate for the outdoors along the Atlantic coast of Florida in the Space Coast. This is my conversation with Captain Noah Miller inside the Outdoor Hour.
Man, well, this is cool. We've been doing the Outdoor Hour for going on 4 years, and we're doing something today for the very first time. I am actually out on the bow of a skiff with a fly rod in my hand, and my good friend Captain Noah Miller back on the pole.
Loving it.
First for you as well?
Yeah, first time recording something on the water like this, other than, you know, filming TV shows and whatnot. But
you've done some TV stuff though?
Yeah, with Captain Jonathan Moss. We've done a few episodes of the Captain's Log TV show with him. But no, first time doing a podcast.
Well, this is kind of special, man. This is a special area. I've been coming here for about 10 years. Been fishing here for, what, 3 or 4 with you. Every time I come here, I'm just captivated by the landscapes, you know.
It's a great area. Right at 12 o'clock, bud.
Yeah.
Not to interrupt you, but the mullet are getting chased right there on that point. I go a little bit more to the right there. Right in that little shady pocket there, right around that point, those mullet were getting real nervous. Good shot. Got him. Strip, strip, strip. Up and right, up and right.
Got him.
Got a little snook there, bud. Sweet. I feel like this podcast might get interrupted by a few fish throughout the course of the day.
I think that's the goal. As soon as we start recording something, we start catching fish.
First time we've ever caught a fish live
on the Outdoor Hour.
There. Ate that little mullet fly.
And he is a big one. This guy is huge.
Oh, yeah. All of 8 inches. Huge.
That's awesome.
Listen, 8 inches is sometimes a good fish, right?
Yeah. That's awesome. Tell you what, a snook and a fly rod, late November. It's hard to beat.
We've had a pretty good morning so far. It's been a little slow, but we managed some fish. We got a little baby tarpon. We got a couple of trout and two snook now, right?
Yep.
Cool.
It's a cool fishery,
Keep
man.
Coming, keep coming. Strip, 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 strip. Got him, strip. Up and right.
On him.
Saw that weight come up behind your fly.
Yep, it's a little better one.
Sweet.
Back to back.
A couple inches bigger than the last fish. We got to get you a real big one today. We'll try to.
Yep.
Find his mama. Oh yeah, that's a little better fish there. Good deal. All right.
Man, after missing a handful of snook early, we're getting into them now.
Well, that was a good strip set you just did, too, which is really the key to burying that hook, is just continue to strip until you really come tight to the fish.
So we do a lot of talking, believe it or not, in Oklahoma on the show about saltwater fly fishing. So why don't you go ahead and give me a report card for our listeners. How bad am I, really?
I mean, yesterday... Do we want to even talk about yesterday? No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, like, right off the plane, you know.
Yeah, you were green. We had to work through a little bit of it. You got out with me for a couple hours, and we just had to work on some technique. You know, going from trout fishing in fresh water to salt water is always a bit of a learning curve, even if you've done it a lot. And remembering to not move your rod when a fish bites your fly is crucial.
And it's crazy.
The rod tip will just flex.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't feel like I'm trout setting, but I'm almost like overcompensating at times and pushing away.
No, and you got to think about it this way. A fish's mouth is what, a couple inches, a few inches, right? The between where your fly is at and the fish's mouth. So even if you swing your rod, you know, a foot to the right, it's all it takes to pull it out of the fish's mouth.
Sure.
Or put a little bit of a bend in the rod now, and now as you strip, you don't have a straight line connection to your fly, and the tip of the rod is taking the force out of the hook set there. And so now you're not able to really stick that fish well. Now sometimes, yeah, you can get away with it, and the fish eats and turns, heads the other direction, hooks itself, you know. And so, but if we're talking about a textbook, perfect strip set, you're gripping the rod lightly with your right hand if you're a right-handed caster, and you're just continuing to do big strips. Nice, doesn't even have to be overly fast. It just needs to be big strips until you feel the weight of the fish come tight in your left hand.
That's been, I think, the biggest adjustment for me, learning the strip set coming from freshwater trout fishing, is I want to test the weight of the fish with my rod to tell if I've got him. I need to give a couple more good strips with the left hand, feel the weight with the left hand before I do anything with the rod.
Right, and we're pulling the boat down a shoreline as well, so the boat's moving oftentimes towards your fish, and then let's say the fish is moving from right to left, you get a presentation across the fish there, out in front of it, the fish turns and it's tracking your fly and then eats it. Now that fish is coming towards you, the boat's moving towards it. It might take you four big strips sometimes, depending on the rate that the fish ate the fly coming towards you. It might even take you four strips before you come tight on that fish. You know, and especially if the fish is really moving quickly at you and bites it and keeps running, it's gonna take a few to get caught up to a fish.
Well, I've caught two snook and the mangroves.
And that's part of it. I always tell people you gotta fish where the fish are, so never worry about casting it and getting stuck in the bushes. We try to use more of a sidearm cast to sneak it under into pockets and under the trees and stuff, but you got to fish where the fish are, and if you're not, you're just not in the game.
Well, for our listeners that maybe don't know specifically, you want to give a little bit of an idea, Noah, where we are and what we're doing?
Sure. We are in the beautiful Space Coast, Florida. I guide from Vero Beach all the way up to Titusville, so that'd be the Treasure and Space Coast area here on the east coast of Central Florida. We have a very beautiful fishery here in the Indian River Lagoon, Banana River Lagoon systems. I don't do any guiding up in the Mosquito Lagoon. I don't have the permit for that, and it's just too far from home for me to stay dialed in on those fish. But Mosquito Lagoon's also beautiful. It's a very fun place to go target redfish up there. We have a pretty diverse fishery here, and we have what I call many seasons. So in the springtime, we have excellent snook fishing, some of the best I've ever seen in the state of Florida right now. Sight fishing snook in shallow water, eating little glass minnows, small bait fish patterns and stuff like that. We're sight fishing snook anywhere from, you know, 18-inch fish rolling down a shoreline all the way up to 40-inch fish. We got three this last summer that were over 40-inch snook. We have just after that, or kind of as that's happening, we have, you know, May, June, July. That is our tarpon season for the migratory tarpon. They'll roll through. And we have a season then where we can target large tarpon in the 40 to, you know, even up into the triple digit range. And then we have juvenile tarpon around as well. Those are kind of around all year here and there. But as our water warms up in the summer months, you get more of them on the flats and more opportunities at them in the backwaters and creek systems and different things that we have that are the little tributaries of the lagoon system. And then as you go on into fall, we get our fall mullet run, and we can target more like trout and snook, redfish, things like that on the flats. We just have a wide variety of fish cruising around. Big jacks are around. It's usually October, and we just have a plethora of fish. And then we go from that into our wintertime fishery, which would be sea trout, redfish, and black drum. We have big schools of tailing black drum in the wintertime that are a lot of fun to target, as well as some bull reds, which you've gotten into a couple of bull reds with me last November when we fished.
Yeah, last year, that was great. And that's one of the things I love about this area. You have told me there's places you can go to just get on tarp, and there's places you can go to just get on reds. Here in this fishery, it feels like it's kind of an evolving and revolving door of seasons and species, and I'm here a variety of times of year because my in-laws live here, and it feels like every time I'm here, it's a little bit different game. We're targeting a little bit different type of fish in a little bit different way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of variety here.
There really is. It's one of the most ecologically diverse systems on the entire planet here. It's amazing. We have a bunch of plant life, animal life, fish, and I've gotten to fish all over the state, and I really love it here. I do call it home. I did grow up here, so I do have a bit of home field advantage, if you want to call it that, but it's really just an amazing fishery, and I never get bored out here. I can go do something different every single day, fish a different shoreline every day, use a different boat ramp every day if I want to, and it never gets old.
I know you had a bit of a career before you did this. Did you grow up fishing like this? Were you a fly angler as a kid?
Yes, so I'm a third generation Floridian, but also angler. My father and my grandfather were both avid fishermen. My dad, you know, would even fish some local tournaments and stuff like that, like I do now. They were not fly fishermen, however. They liked light tackle. One of my dad's favorite things was to fish a ultralight spinning rod with 6-pound mono, 4-pound mono, and he liked to throw topwater plugs, or he had a few different lures he would like, but he would target sea trout.
Hmm.
That was his fish of choice, was a big sea trout.
Do you know why?
You know, growing up back then, they called redfish channel bass. that it wasn't really as sought after as a game fish. A big trout was a trophy. It still is a trophy fish to catch a really big trout. And it was kind of like the cool fish to target at the time. And so that was his thing growing up. We were always trout fishing. So I kind of came up doing that. And then my best friend, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, his dad was also into outdoors and hunting and fishing and stuff. But he was into fly fishing, and we were up in North Carolina at the time, and we were just going to go do some fishing. And he goes, "Hey, have you ever tied a fly before?" We're all hanging out at his house. I said, "Well, no, I'm a little kid." He said, "Okay, well, do you want to?" I said, "Sure." You know, always was obsessed with everything fishing. So tied a few flies before I'd ever even thrown a fly rod, and then we went out and we started doing some fly fishing. My parents bought me a cheap clam pack style, trying to think the name of the company, just a real basic, it wasn't like a Fluger, but it was something along the lines of that, just real basic little 5-weight, right? And man, I fished the crap out of that thing, caught a bunch of fish, caught a bunch of trout, rainbows and browns and brookies and stuff there in North Carolina, Tennessee. So I kind of got a taste of that there in the mountains of North Carolina, near Silva, actually. That was the area we would fish. And then coming back to Florida, I did a lot of bass fishing and whatever I could ride my bike to, right? So I would bring the fly rod occasionally and throw some streamers and throw some little bugs for bluegill or bass and caught them on fly. But I really did a lot of light tackle inshore fishing still, because that's what I came up doing. And then I, as I got older, I, was able to drive, and I'd go wade fishing and got a canoe. I would get dropped off in the canoe at different areas, and, the parents would be like, "Okay, we'll pick you up at dark." So yeah, long story short, I came up fishing, did some fly fishing. I didn't get as into fly fishing in saltwater until I was a little bit older, but that was just kind of the next challenge, the next evolution in my fishing career. I did some other outside jobs growing up. So, I did tree work, landscaping. I owned my own landscape business for a while as well before I went into guiding full time. And just always spent my life in the outdoors and most of it on the water. So,
at what point did you get bit by the tarpon bug?
I was always enthralled with the idea of tarpon because my dad had these books, Stuap books on tarpon fishing and tarpon and all this. And he had this story about fishing a fishing trip he had taken in Costa Rica. And again, he's not a fly angler, so he was out fishing with a guide. And he was in a 14-foot John boat. And they were out trolling mirror lures for tarpon. And he hooked a triple-digit fish. Fought this fish for a while. Gets it up to the boat, and out of nowhere, a hammerhead comes up and eats it. Bites his fish right in half. So that was a story. That was his only big tarpon fishing experience and story that I had growing up. So I was always kind of obsessed with this idea of tarpon fishing, right? So then I got a little older, and I started doing some wade fishing and fishing on my own and stuff. And again, my dad wasn't a tarpon fisherman here locally. He wanted to target trout. So we didn't really do it. But I remember a couple of times we'd be out and I'd be fishing with friends or whatnot, and I'd catch a tarpon on a topwater plug or something like that. And so, yeah, I did catch some tarpon on light tackle before I ever did the fly thing. And then it's like burned into my brain, the first tarpon that I ever caught on a fly rod, as it probably is for most people. But I was fishing out of my kayak, and I was fishing an 8-weight. I jumped a few tarpon, but I connected on a fish that was probably 10, 12 pounds on a chartreuse bait fish pattern up in some backwaters, dirty water. Saw the fish roll, made a cast. Fish absolutely destroyed the fly, right? Jumped 4 or 5 times, and I got a hold of that fish. And man, the feeling of a tarpon connected to your fly rod Like, you know, it's amazing. You can feel every little head shake and everything through the rod. And
there's an electricity there that you can't really find in many others.
Right. And it's the Silver King, right? Even the smaller ones they're tricky. They're not easy. They have really tough mouths that are hard to get a hook into.
I hope you're enjoying this conversation from the field inside the Outdoor Hour this week. After the break, we've got more with Captain Noah Miller. We're going to talk more about tarpon. We're going to talk about some specific conservation challenges that are facing this Indian River, Banana River Lagoon system, and the fight that anglers and guides like Captain Noah Miller are in the midst of for the health and longevity of this fishery. We've got more ahead inside the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
You're listening to The Outdoor Hour with your hosts Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back inside the Outdoor Hour. In this segment, I am on a skiff with my good buddy Captain Noah Miller off the Atlantic coast of Florida, targeting snook, tarpon, redfish, jacks. We've got a great, great week of fishing. And in the middle of that, we had conversation about this awesome fishery and some of the threats specifically right now to the sea trout inside this fishery. There's been a lot of habitat change. There are some politics at play, and the balance of the sustainability of sea trout in this region, which was once hailed as the sea trout capital of the world, is in the fold. So listen for more of that conversation here with Captain Noah Miller inside the Outdoor Hour.
Tell me about the overall health of the fishery. How is it? How's it been? Have you seen it change?
So unfortunately, all the way back in 2010, we had a really bad freeze in February of that year. And when that happened, we lost a ton of our fish. And the nutrient load from that ended up causing or adding fuel to the fire of our algae blooms that we get, which are, you know, they're cyclical, they're part of the life cycle of the lagoon, but what happens is when you have humans introducing chemicals, fertilizers, and other, you know, contaminants into the lagoon, plus a very bad freeze from nature, and that added all these dead fish to the lagoon, dead snook, dead tarpon, fish that can't handle that water temperature, that brown algae just takes over. And so when the water gets warm in the summertime, we have these algae blooms that the water gets so dirty and thick in certain areas that it blocks the light out and it can't get down to the seagrass. And without any light getting to the seagrass, you have no photosynthesis and you lose your grass. And as a result of that, we lost about 90% between 2010 and 2016, we lost about 90% of our seagrass here in the Indian River and Banana River Lagoon system. Mosquito Lagoon held on to their grass a little bit longer, and it's actually coming back a little bit sooner. That part of the reason for that is that Mosquito Lagoon is a little to the north of us, and it's a little bit cooler temperature in that part of the state, and that brown algae doesn't like colder water as much. So they're doing a little bit better. That grass is coming back a little better. But overall, our health of the lagoon, we have a great fishery here and it's fun. However, it should be better than it is. And we're fighting really hard to do some things about that between different projects to restore some seagrass and some shorelines and plant mangroves. And there's a lot of organizations that are really doing some good job to help with that. And then we had talked about yesterday, one of the big fights that we're in right now is trying to get our sea trout closed for harvest. Sea trout are extremely reliant on the seagrass, especially as younger fish, right? So fish, I'm talking about fish that are fry all the way up until about 12 to 15 inch fish. Those guys really need cover. They don't want to use mangroves. That's not their habitat. They want to be on shallow flats in between anywhere from a foot to 4 or 5 feet of depth, and they want to be in sandy potholes with grass surrounding them. They want to lay in the grass, they want to lay in the potholes. They're ambush predator kind of fish, and they don't have a lot of endurance. So what that means is, if that fish doesn't have somewhere that it can dart out, grab a meal, and then dive back into the grass, into a pothole, into some kind of cover, it's very susceptible to getting chased down and eaten by any kind of predator. And that could be a dolphin, that could be a shark, a jack, a larger trout. They'll eat their own oftentimes. So there's lots of predators that want to eat a trout. Matter of fact, our dolphin population here, porpoises, they love to eat trout. It makes up about 80% of their diet. And that being said, our numbers due to seagrass loss here in the lagoon has just plummeted. This used to be the sea trout capital of the entire world here in the Indian River Lagoon system. And Taylor just put a hook in his shirt.
Smack!
Smack. But we're trying to get back to what it used to be, you know, back before the 2010 freeze. And I think we can do it, but we need to get sea trout closed for harvest. So there's a online form you can fill out all through the Fish and Game Florida Wildlife Commission. I've been traveling around the state speaking and doing my part to try and get some awareness for the lagoon, for our sea trout population, and try to help them out. If they can have a break, even if we just close it for a couple of years and allow them to kind of catch up, I think it would really help. We closed redfish for harvest for the same exact reason, which was habitat loss, about 3 years ago, and we've seen a really big return on our redfish population. So it does work, and it can really be an effective way to help boost the population of fish in the area. And while I don't think that over-harvesting is the root cause of our problem for sea trout, I absolutely believe that it is habitat loss. We can do our part as anglers and fishermen to make sure that they all go back in the water and go make babies and help just propagate the entire population of sea trout. And maybe one day, within the next 10 years or so, we'll be able to call the Indian River Lagoon area here the sea trout capital of the world again, where we have shots at 30-inch, you know, 10-pound gator trout every single time we go out like we used to, because that was the case. You used to be able to go out and have shots at really big trout every time you were on the water.
What is the biggest challenge you find in terms of, like, public opinion on this? Is it just an awareness campaign?
It's a bit of both. So you do have some people that are, you know, they want to harvest their trout. They want to be able to retain them. And there's a couple of aspects to that I do understand. There's one aspect of it where they said, they're like, I just don't want the government to take anything away from me because I'll never get it back.
Sure. You look at cases like bear hunting in certain areas, mountain
lion.
Yeah,
and that's
hunting.
Absolutely the case, and I understand that. I'm an American. I'm a red-blooded American. I don't want the government taking my rights away either. But we also have to look at the bigger picture as far as numbers of fish. FWC's biologists, in my opinion, haven't done maybe the best job at looking at the numbers of adult fish in our area. They do, like, say, netting, and they net a bunch of the smaller fish. And even that being said, their numbers are showing that we're in really, really bad decline numbers-wise. So with that being said, and then all of the other guides in the area being like, hey, we need to do something here because this is an issue, it's really telling to the, you know, population. But when you're just an average fisherman that goes out and you hit your couple of trout holes and you catch your limit of trout and you go in, maybe you don't see that, right? So it is bringing some awareness to the issues out there. The commercial guys are a good example of this. And I have nothing against commercial fishermen. I think, you know, everyone's got to make a living on the water just like I do. They make theirs harvesting fish. I make mine showing fish to people and giving them an experience. But the difference is, like, those commercial guys, just like I do, I can go find you a trout because it's my job. Commercial guy can go find a trout because it's his job. And they can go fish the areas that those trout congregate at. And so those commercial guys are saying something different as far as, well, we don't want the government to take our fish away and the ability to make money harvesting sea trout. But also, they're saying, well, maybe you guys just don't know how to catch them. This is word for word out of a commercial guy's mouth at a meeting I was at. Well, maybe people just don't know how to catch sea trout because we can go out and catch them. Well, that's true. You're a commercial fisherman. If you didn't know how to catch them, you're probably out of business pretty quick.
Sure.
But what we want to do is manage for abundance to the point that it'll be back to the way it was before 2010. You could go fish around any of these spoil islands. I can see 3, 4, 5 spoil islands right here, and you could go catch trout around them all day long, any time of day. Almost didn't matter what color fly, jig, lure you threw, you were going to find some sea trout, and it's not like that any longer.
And a ban on harvesting sea trout doesn't affect your ability to make money on the water, but it would for commercial fishermen.
It would for commercial guys.
Look at
absolutely
that shot.
So one of the things that I proposed also was, hey, just buy them out. Whether you close it for 2 years, 3 years, you take state of Florida, just cut them a check for whatever they might make, and then we close it for a little bit and give them a chance to come back, and then allow the commercial guys to go back to it. Now, commercial guys still don't like that idea because they're afraid they're never going to get it back.
Sure.
And again, I understand it. But from my side of the fence, I'm really pushing for them to close it for harvest just like we did for redfish, because I've seen it work. It does work. And, you know, for an overall food value of fish, there's plenty of better fish to eat out here than a sea trout as well. So
you know that it's working because of the experience with the redfish. Tell me more about that. How do you know it's working? What is the end goal, and how do you know when you're there?
So every 3 years, FWC does studies on the fish management, or they're really doing studies on fish throughout the years, but every 3 years they make adjustments to the rules, the regulations, as they need to. So they're looking at numbers of fish, as well as us guides and anglers that are on the water 200, 300 days a year, right? So we're just seeing overall better numbers of redfish, better size of redfish. 3 years ago, you'd pull certain shorelines and you would see 4 fish all day that were 18 to 22 inch fish. Now you go pull some of those same shorelines, we're seeing fish that are 28, 30 inch fish, and we're seeing way more of them. We're seeing fish like the snook that we caught earlier that had a little hole in its face that was healing from being caught previously.
Yep.
Well, we're seeing that same kind of thing with our redfish, that they have a little hole in their face that's healing because someone caught that fish and it would have been a slot fish. Well, they released it and now we got to enjoy that fish as well. So we're seeing better numbers overall and better quality sized fish as well, which is also really good because the larger the fish is, with redfish and sea trout both, which are both in the drum family, the larger the fish is, the more eggs they're going to produce. So the more large fish we have around as well, it's going to exponentially cause our fishery to explode with a new, you know, group of fish within, you know, even just a few spawn cycles. It'll really help our numbers to come back.
At what point do you open redfish for harvest again?
I would say that would be a habitat conversation, right? So we close it because of habitat loss. If we are successful with all these attempts that we're doing to restore some grass and put some clams and oysters back here in the lagoon to help filter the water, and we're getting our grass back to the overall health that it should be, then you open it back up because it's now sustainable. It's like, imagine a wildfire swept across a forest that you hunt deer in, right? And it went from a lush, beautiful forest, lots of food for the animals, to bare dirt and dead sticks. That's the equivalent of what happened when we lost all our seagrass. It's just the underwater version of that. And so once you get that growth back, like wherever you hunt, the management is not really going to let you hunt something like that, right? It's carrying capacity, just like it is for anywhere else. You got to have food for your animals there if you're going to allow them to be harvested. So that being said, you got to have a habitat that can sustain harvesting. And once you get that back, that's when I think you open it up. And I think we are getting there. We are seeing our seagrass come back in certain areas, especially down around south of the Sebastian Inlet here and then up in the Mosquito Lagoon. There are certain areas that are really starting to come back good, which is really encouraging to see. I mean, I haven't seen grass in some of those areas, like I said, in, you know, over 10 years, 12 years. So it's really good to see that, and it's encouraging, and I think we can get there. As far as this particular battle goes, though, getting sea trout closed would, especially with the grass coming back, would allow a jump start, a kick start to our overall numbers of fish that we have, and give us some better quality size fish.
So it's interesting because obviously as an outdoorsman and a conservationist, you're concerned about the overall holistic health of the fishery, not just the number of fish. That's why the seagrass is such a hot, you know, topic of conversation for you and me. You can close redfish to harvest, you can close sea trout to harvest, and improve, you know, in an acute sense, the numbers of those species. But until you're actually tackling the greater challenge, which is that seagrass shortage, it's almost for naught, right? You've got
more
fish,
absolutely,
but it's not sustainable.
Right, yeah. No, exactly. And that's why you have, it's like you don't want to put a Band-Aid on something that needs a tourniquet, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it is. But at the same time, we can't sit here and do nothing. So it's a balancing act of, okay, so maybe, you know, like we said, we don't want to remove all ability to harvest fish out of the lagoon. Maybe there's plenty of fish that are plentiful out here, but maybe for the game fish species, we close it until we have that sustainable fishery back again, where it's healthy to where it should be.
And maybe the general public, because we talk a lot on the show, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, we don't really need more outdoorsmen. What we need is more people that appreciate what outdoorsmen do and advocate for this type of recreation. How can just the general public have a positive impact in this fight for the fishery?
I think educating yourself on how your particular ecosystem that you interact with works, right? There's YouTube videos on everything. There's plenty of free articles that you can read if you're interested. But learn how your ecosystem works and where it needs help and get involved one way or the other. There's people out here that, like, the sea trout is my fight that I'm fighting for right now. But there's people out here that are planting mangroves. There's people out here that are making oyster mats and putting those out here in the lagoon. They're hanging, they own docks, but they hang oysters off of their docks. So there's different ways to get involved, but I think if you understand and appreciate the part of the environment that you're using, because you're going to be more passionate about that and you're going to want to protect it. And I think if you can do that and figure out how you can get involved, there's a million different ways that you can help. And that could be, it doesn't even have to be fishing related, right? There's all sorts of different organizations you can become a part of. If it's fishing, there's things like Bonefish Tarpon Trust and all those organizations out there that you can get in touch with and support financially or volunteer for. And there's just a lot of ways you could do it. But I think get to know your, you know, estuary, your forest, your whatever that you're actively engaged with, in a very intimate way, so you can understand where the problems might be.
Hope you're enjoying this conversation with Captain Noah Miller as we fly fish for tarpon, snook, reds, jacks, sea trout, and more. We've got more of this conversation ahead on the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Now back to the Outdoor Hour with your hosts Taylor Maples and Josh Stratton on 107.7 The Franchise.
Welcome back. It's our final segment this week. We're fly fishing the saltwater flats of the Atlantic coast of Florida this week. I'm out on a skiff with Captain Noah Miller, and we're chasing tarpon, we're chasing redfish. We've caught a couple of snook during this episode. And we're talking a lot about tarpon and sea trout and the sustainability of this fishery. I hope you enjoy this different type of Outdoor Hour content. You're actually going to hear me making casts, stripping in line. You'll hear Captain Noah Miller poling, pushing us around these salt flats as we search for fish. It's something different, and I hope you enjoy it. This is the Outdoor Hour on 107.7 The Franchise.
Well, this really is a special place. You know, as I'm sitting here bouncing casts off docks, we've got egrets, we've got ospreys hunting overhead, herons, pelicans, you know, we've seen otters today, sea turtles. For being such a unknown area, you know, little known maybe, part of the coast in Florida, there's massive hubs for tourism. There's massive hubs for entertainment, and even for, you know, angling. I don't know that this is somewhere that I think of first when I think of coming to Florida to pursue saltwater game species, but it has become my favorite because of how special it is and how unique it is. And it's something I struggle with as an outdoorsman because I like to go to Idaho and big game hunt. I like to go to Florida and saltwater fly fish. I feel like I have to always force myself to go beyond consumer in these arenas, you know, and I am involved with Bonefish Tarpon Trust, and I am involved with a number of those types of bodies, but just in like the $35 a year capacity, right? Because
sure,
there's very little I can do to get involved other than financially with Bonefish and Tarpon Trust from Colorado, from Oklahoma, wherever it is I live now. You know, I know over on the other coast, there was a big fight amongst guides for parking in Boca Grande Pass and obviously opening passes and things like that. There are always, whether they're political or whatever these fights are to be involved with. And I think education is a big piece of it. If you care about a place the way that I care about this place, it's not how I consistently recreate. It's not somewhere I make a living, but it's somewhere that I enjoy coming. And it is somewhere that I have a responsibility to advocate for because I want to come here for the rest of my life. And I want to bring my kids here. And when my daughters get a little bit older, I want to bring them on a skiff with you. And
yeah,
I want to be able to show them populations of sea trout and bull reds and tarpon and all of that. I don't want to have to go to the Keys for that and to the Gulf for the reds. And
right.
And it is all of our responsibility, regardless of how you choose to recreate. What is good often for one group, I think the most correct answer is the best for all groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it muddy because we as humans are very selfish at times, and it's easy as a commercial angler to say, well, here's what benefits me, that's right. But we need people that can see these issues holistically and work together, even if it means sacrificing on the fish that you want to keep for a few years.
No,
or
absolutely.
Whatever.
Yep. No, it's really true, and I think you hit the nail on the head about, you know, having a responsibility to leave something for your children that's going to be better, hopefully, than what you even got to experience. And that's my hope for my kids too, as well, so that one day I don't have to say to them, well, you know, it was so good back in the day. I can say, wow, look what we fought for and look what we won,
yeah,
to have this for you now,
yeah,
because it wasn't like this.
Yeah, you know, at the direction, and maybe this is a little aggressive, but direction and pace things are going for the sea trout, you're going to hear stories, your kids will hear stories of granddad catching sea trout and say, what's a sea trout?
No, it's really true. I mean, like I said, we used to be able to go out and there was so many of them. Even on these shorelines and stuff that we're fishing,
that just,
it was a mullet jumping,
yeah,
up there. But you used to have to weed through sea trout to the point that it was almost annoying. And
huh,
that's how it should be. When it's healthy here, that is how it should be. You should have no problem having a 20-fish day,
huh,
on sea trout. And that's through the course of not even targeting them, but just casting for other fish.
Sure.
Like, that's what our fishery should be. Now, you know, you find a little hole with a bunch of trout in it, you're like, oh, cool. Like, let's enjoy this because we might not find them again the next day.
Sure.
Like, we found some trout yesterday and we went back this morning. We got two where we got, what, six?
Six, yeah.
You know, and there's just those little holes like that are few and far, fewer and farther between, to the point now that, you know, us guides are even calling each other and being like, hey, I need some trout for this trip. And we're trying to get a slam or a grand slam for our anglers. Like, do you know where any trout are at? Like, and that just should never be the case for this fishery here.
That's a good shot. So you mentioned the grand slam. I assume we have many listeners that have no experience with saltwater fishing. You've talked about several of the species that are around here. What's your goal when you're out here? Are you looking to get kind of a mixed bag, try to hit a slam, something like that?
How
do you play it?
I love getting slams with clients. I feel like it's a lot of bang for your buck throughout the day to be able to get a so let me clarify too. There's different slams for different regions. If you were to go to the Keys, a grand slam there would be a tarpon, a bonefish, and a permit, and a super slam would be if you add a snook to that list. Now, here on the Space Coast and Treasure Coast of Florida, a slam would be a sea trout, a redfish, and a snook, and if you add a tarpon to that, that would be a grand slam. So I try to target a grand slam, you know, when I can, but there are definitely times in the summer where we are strictly tarpon fishing. If we catch a snook, we catch a redfish, or we catch a sea trout through that process of the day, that's fine. But most of the guys that are booking me in the late spring through the summer, we're tarpon fishing. You know, if tarpon fishing's a little slow one day or whatever, sure, we might go try to do something else for a little bit just to kind of break it up. But overall, we're tarpon fishing. Part of that is that's my favorite fish. And part of that is just, you know, hard not to love a tarpon. Yeah, I see that big snook right there where you got a big old tangle.
Yeah.
That's how you know you're going to see one, right? You get a little casting knot there in your leader, and then the fish show up. Or your phone rings, and you got to take a phone call, and then it's just like the flats will come alive. I promise it works that way almost every time.
I tell you what, and our listeners will understand this because many of them recreate in the outdoors via deer hunting and bow hunting especially. Tarpon fever is a different beast, man. It's... It's embarrassing for me because I feel buck fever. I don't know that I'm one that would say there are physical effects for me of buck fever to a point of negatively impacting my hunt. I don't even feel like I'm amped up when I'm on the bow or your skiff. And it's like you say the word tarpon and everything just falls to pieces.
Yeah. No, you almost forget, you know, how to cast. You're like Ricky Bobby. I don't know what to do with my hands, you know.
And I'm like, I feel cool, man. I feel real cool. You're like, hey, take a deep breath. And I'll look down and my heart rate's like 110 on my Garmin. And I'm like, man, I don't feel that amped up. But it's special, man.
It really is. And for me as a guide, I feel that way a lot. Just from seeing the fish and getting the opportunity for my angler to make the shot. So I love that feeling, and we kind of all are chasing that thrill, right? That's part of why we love what we do so much. It's a challenge. We're interacting with nature and all of that too, but we want to be successful, and we try really hard to be technical and good at what we're doing. And so when you get these great opportunities and you see a laid up tarpon or you see a snook floating or whatever the case may be, you just feel that adrenaline start to course through your veins and you get so excited. It's just,
it's
indescribable.
It is. I feel extremely fortunate. I've been coming to Florida for many years between traveling for baseball and high school. You know, dating and now being married to my wife who is from Florida. And for many years, fishing while I was here was never even on my brain. I thought, yeah, it'd be so cool. I would love coming down to the water and watching people throw fly rods off of the bows of skiffs. And it felt so unattainable to me. And I remember saying, man, if I ever got a chance to go tarpon fishing or to do that one time, it just felt like it was a bucket list thing to even get to say I had done. And obviously really fortunate that I get to do this several times a year now with you, but it can be that easy. Sometimes you just need to book the trip and do the thing. And, I hope that that's one of the things I can do with this show and these segments is help people understand, like, these bucket list trips are just at the end of your willingness to say, hey, I'm going to do these things. I got a good buddy, Trevor, who, that was a good shot.
Great shot.
Took a doll sheep hunt up in the McKenzie Range, Northwest Territories. And one of his grandfather's quotes was, make your dreams memories. And I feel like that's such a cool perspective.
I love that.
But I tell you what, if you're going to be on the Space Coast, check out Captain Noah Miller. We'll put his Instagram handle and all that and some captions on these posts, and highly, highly recommend. Introduced to me by a good friend, Dustin Doss, who is my White River trout bum buddy. First time you and I fished together was with Dustin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dustin's a good guy.
He's kind of found himself a little bit of a home down here at times.
Yeah, he comes down a month or so at a time now. He'll fish with me and he'll bring his boat down and do a little fishing.
I love it because it's very humbling to see guys that I look up to as anglers struggle with a fishery, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To watch guys like he and Brennan, and they don't do it nearly as often, but miss a hook set or lift a fly rod or something like that. These guys that, you know, on a small scale, I kind of idolize and look up to in my own fishing world. It is very humbling. You know, you watch all these things on Yeti and on Netflix, and you got guys like Mangum that are missing sets and stuff. It happens to all of us.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's the thing to remember too, is if you can learn to embrace the struggle and embrace the journey, it's not really about the destination. It really is about the journey. And then you watch all these videos and everything, but you know, maybe you watch a blooper reel or something like that. But 9 times out of 10, those guys are only showing you when it all goes right. They're not showing you the 100 times it didn't.
Yeah.
You know, so that's super, super important to remember as well, is the journey is everything. It's just as much as the destination is, you know. Yes, it's great to actually get that bucket list fish and all of that, but don't forget to enjoy the journey and smell the roses along the way.
I am constantly fighting myself up here on the bow of your boat between being satisfied just being here, because it is cool. I spend all year looking forward to these couple of days we get to spend together around Thanksgiving, and saying, hey, it's not about catching fish, it's about being where fish get caught.
Yeah.
Versus the competitiveness of, dang it, I want that freaking fish and I want it now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of fish, what do you think?
I think we should make a run. We really just need a redfish just to finish out our slam. Let's buzz around the corner and see if we can get on a little flat that might have some redfish on it.
See if we can make that happen.
All right, dude. Let's do it.
That's going to do it this week for us inside the Outdoor Hour. I really hope you enjoyed this content this week. Something a little bit different. We're going to try to push this outside of the radio studio more frequently. And I'm really interested to hear what type of content you want to hear, where you'd like us to go, who you want us to talk to. We'll get you more sights and sounds and experiences inside the Outdoor Hour, and I'm grateful that you would join us. As always, you can follow the show on social media at outdoor_hour. You can follow me specifically at T_Maples. If you'd like to connect with Captain Noah Miller, maybe to book a trip or ask some questions or just see some of the images that he's constantly posting from his trips out in the Space Coast, he is on Instagram at Captain Noah Miller. It is CAPT_Noah_Miller. That's CAPT_Noah_Miller. Check him out there. Let us know where you want us to go next. Thank you for listening to the Outdoor Hour. We appreciate you. We'll see you next time. Until then, go boldly. We'll see you outdoors.